On this episode of Skeptico.
If a connection between the myths and the constellation is acknowledged, a way that it is commonly explained away is, well, primitive early humans looking at the world around them, awesome forces, thunderstorms, earthquakes, volcanoes, had to explain it. They didn't have science. So they say, well, there's a god in the volcano and he or she is mad right now. And there's the sun. And of course, we're going to all our gods will come from the sun. This is kind of the conventional narrative. It was early humans. Then it was primitive kind of pastoral shepherding stuff. Then it was settled down in agriculture. And then we had cities. Finally, you know, we had time to look at the stars and do science and primitive science. And then it got better and better. And that's kind of the general timeline. So it is not primitive gropings that somehow, oh, look at this. These primitive myths somehow later on, thousands of years later, evolved to point to incredible spiritual truths. It's like saying, yeah, people were waxing the cars for centuries and then boom, they knew karate as a master. That's just ridiculous. Or if it came from ancient aliens, where'd they get it? Presumably they evolved somewhere, right? So it's like we've got two choices. Either this came from the spirit world right off the bat, or some culture evolved to some incredibly advanced level and figured it out.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science and spirituality with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Akaris, and one of the reoccurring themes of this show is that dominant paradigms have a tendency to stick around maybe longer than they should, and that often the downfall of these paradigms can be traced to the work of one individual. And I think that's the case with today's guest, David Matheson. Because although David didn't invent astrotheology, he's taken our understanding of the constellations in the night sky and how they relate to our myths and our culture to a whole different level. I really enjoyed getting to know David. I spent quite a bit of time researching this and trying to get my arms around this topic. It's a longer interview than I usually do, but I just couldn't get all the information into a shorter form, so there you have it. Or I should say, now you have it, because here is my interview with David Matheson. Today we welcome David Matheson to Skeptico. David is the author of Star Myths of the World, Volume 1, 2, and 3, along with several other books we might talk about. But those Star Myths books I was just alluding to are quite amazing. I mean, here's a collection of over 2,000 pages of diagrams, illustrations, and analysis of the stars, the constellations and the myths surrounding those constellations, and also just our enduring fascination with the night sky. David is a graduate of West Point. He also has a master's degree in literature from Texas A&M, and it's really quite wonderful to have him on. I'm looking forward to this conversation. David, welcome to Skeptico.
Thanks so much, Alex. I'm really looking forward to the conversation as well and hope that listeners enjoy it.
So, you know, we've had quite an email exchange back and forth. I've had a great time digging into this really pretty amazing body of research that you've amassed. And one of the things I still can't quite wrap my arms around is how one person, without any academic affiliation or really academic support, has amassed this body of research. And so I thought we might start with really some of the basics of how you got started in this, who you are, more about your background. I think people are going to be immediately interested in just that throwaway point that you went to West Point, you know, and you're in the military for a long time. And I don't know that that plays directly into this story, but, you know, start wherever you want. How did this whole thing begin for you?
Okay. Yeah. How did one person? So I'm not, I like everybody else, I'm standing on the shoulders of others who have gone before and talked about these things. There have been authors down through the years who have looked at the myths and especially the Bible, but also the myths, like the Greek myths or the classical Greek and Roman myths. You know, so there's authors going all the way back to the Roman times Macrobius was kind of late Roman Empire, but others, Lucian of Samosata in earlier in the Roman times, and then even Aristotle and Plato actually refer kind of in offhanded ways to this. Some of the early church fathers we could get into actually do mention this sort of thing.
So when we say this sort of thing, because I kind of even glossed over that, I mean, we're talking about all the star myths that we all grew up with in the terms of the Zodiac and Hercules and all the things in the Disney movies. All those things are reflected in, we know they're reflected in the stars. We don't know what the association is, but that's kind of permeated our culture in a lot of different ways. And that's what you're examining here.
Right. So actually, you're right. I should have said, actually, I don't think we all grew up with the teaching that every single myth and story around the world, including the Bible, is based on the stars. But there is this awareness, especially in the Greek myths, every now and then, you know, after a great hero like Hercules is done with his career and, you know, dies or goes up to heaven, you'll get this line that says, and then the gods hung his form in the stars so that, you know, only certain heroes or monsters get placed in the stars. And that's kind of that connection is there and we're kind of dimly aware of it. But usually the understanding is, well, the myths came first and then we named the stars after them. You know, the planet Jupiter, of course, there's this god named Jupiter or Zeus. So probably they named that planet after the god. But there, as I was alluding to, there have been these voices down through the centuries and even up into the modern times. One very influential book on my work and on a lot of other people, I first found out about this book from reading Graham Hancock and others in that genre of investigation about humanity's ancient history, is Hamlet's Mill. And they said, hey, you've got it backwards. It's not that these constellations are named after the myth. Far from it. The myth is based on the constellation. And that may not seem like such a big, like, oh, okay, what's the big deal? It's a huge paradigm shift. And that's, so if we grew up with these, what I like to call star myths, most, I don't think anybody is teaching, or very few people grew up with the teaching that actually all the myths of the world can, and the, not just the myths, but the sacred scriptures, including the Bible, Old and New Testament of the Bible, but also scriptures such as the Vedas of India, or the Veds of India, all the scriptures of the world, all the sacred stories and traditions, some of them not necessarily ever written down, but passed down in oral traditions in Australia and the Polynesian, the Oceania, the Pacific Islands, all those cultures have myths. In fact, that's the largest dispersion of the same myth. Like the Maui stories stretch all the way from Hawaii to New Zealand, Aotearoa, which is a vast distance. It's like 4,500 miles that way and then 5,000. It's a huge square.
And now, David, let me just interject, because now we're getting into some of the unique contributions and, but we can't say they're contributions yet, but this is getting into some of the stuff that has been the result of your research, has been the conclusions that you've drawn that really go against what conventional wisdom and even the alternative conventional wisdom has thought. Fascinating stuff. I want to get there, and we're going to spend a lot of time on that. But I'm still, just real quickly, you're at West Point, you're in the Army, you're a Christian, right? I mean,
that's right. So I was a literalist Christian for 20 years of my adult life.
And meaning, what did that mean for you? How did that manifest for you? What were you doing?
I was jumping out of airplanes in the 82nd Airborne and, saying a prayer before I went out the door. I wasn't raised in a strict religious upbringing. I did go to Sunday school, but kind of dropped off with that about fourth grade. It wasn't any sort of very major emphasis, but, it was kind of a background. It's kind of a background part of the culture in many parts of the West in the United States. In the Army, it is more. There are chaplains running around. Actually, you know, I was only half joking about being in the 82nd. At one point, I was an officer, so I went to West Point. Actually got into a lot of Taoist stuff while I was at West Point. I wasn't really actively Christian or active in any sort of church stuff at West Point, but reading a lot of interesting, all kinds of interesting things. But when I got to the 82nd, actually, I had a job that put me out of the airplane door on one side of the aircraft first in line, because I had to figure out all the people in the battalion. I was the S1, it was called. So the S1 goes out first and has to get track of everybody, find out if anyone's injured. The chaplain goes out the door on the other side in case anybody's seriously hurt or in battle. If someone's shot, the chaplain's got to get to them. So we were actually co-located in the field a lot. So I spent a lot of time in the Army talking to the chaplain at that particular job. And I also happened to be going through a pretty rocky relationship at that point. So anyway, that's when I really became, there was a lot in the Bible and actually the works of people like C.S. Lewis, writers like C.S. Lewis that spoke to me. I think there's a lot of truth and beauty that's in there. And so I took it literally and tried to take it very seriously. It read only biblical things on Sunday, you know, didn't read, even when I was going to grad school, didn't read homework stuff on Sunday, just read Puritan writers or straight out of the Bible for 20 years. So I learned the Bible pretty well, but I also was a literature major, fascinated by mythology, have been fascinated by the stars since I was young. We can talk about the importance of H.A. Rey. We should talk about that. I was introduced to H.A. Rey before. I can't even remember ever not having access to the books, the star books of H.A. Rey. So in the Army, you're actually out under the stars all the time. I mean, you spend a lot of time. I was in the infantry sleeping or not sleeping, walking through the woods at night, walking through the desert at night. I was out in the desert of California at the National Training Center at Fort Irwin, down there in near Joshua Tree, when that comet Hale Bopp was in the sky. And this was kind of before the internet was really a big deal. So I didn't even know when we went there that that comet was coming. And I remember one night going out, walking out of a tent, like a headquarters tent, a battalion headquarters tent, and looking up in this dazzling desert sky. Of course, you know, no lights allowed to come out of the tent. So everything's pretty dark. And the desert sky, all these stars gleaming like, you know, jewels in the sky. And there's this massive comet. And I was just flabbergasted. I didn't even know this comet was coming. So anyway, the Army, you do spend a lot of time walking around at night. And you actually do learn a little bit about navigating your way.
Sure.
This was back in the days before. I remember when we got our first handheld GPS, there was only six for the whole company of 120 guys in the 82nd Airborne, 120 soldiers in this particular company. We got six were issued, you know, one for the company commander, one for the executive officer, one for the first sergeant. It wasn't like everybody had these things back then. So, you got to stop me because I'll go off on these big, long tangents.
No. A lot of that's really interesting. So, you know, so how does this transformation happen? Because your work now is, you know, quite different from all that. What happens?
That's right. So I was actually after I left the Army, I was always very interested in the ancient Egyptians. Even when I was little, I used to make little, I mean, we went and saw the King Tut exhibit. I don't know if you remember when that came around. I think it was 78 or 79. I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, went and saw the King Tut exhibit, was just fascinated by that. So I've always been fascinated by ancient Egypt. I used to use up, you know, the teachers would stop me from using up all the masking tape in the classroom to make these little mummy dolls out of popsicle sticks. I mean, it was like a project we had to prepare for the King Tut exhibit. Everyone got a popsicle stick, made mummy with the tape. But I, like, you know, I was like, oh, I'm making hundreds of mummies. I was really fascinated by ancient Egypt, ancient Greece, grew up loving the myths of Greek myths, Norse myths. And then actually when my parents went to, Machu Picchu. This was after I got out of the Army. I was like, oh, I'm going to get my parents a book, get my mom a book for her birthday. And I bought her Graham Hancock's Heaven's Mirror because it's got beautiful pictures, fantastic pictures. Graham Hancock's wife, Santa Faya, did all these fantastic photographs. Lots of them are at Machu Picchu. I said, this is a great book. I'll get that for my mom. And you know, when I got it, before I signed the inside, you know, happy birthday, make a card, wrap it up, I was like, looking at, wow, this is, what is this guy talking about? So after I gave it to her, I started getting more into what Graham Hancock had written. And he mentioned Hamlet's Mill. And so I started, you know, looking at all these different sources. And in Hamlet's Mill, they talk about the myths being based on the stars. And I was totally open to that. I was like, wow, that's fantastic. I see how that, it absolutely lines up. But every now and then they would say, oh, and here's this Bible story and it's based on the stars too. And I would go, ooh, I'm not really too open to that idea because I'm taking the Bible literally. And if it's all based on the stars, then we have some kind of mental gymnastics to do. Or, you know, there's lots of possibilities where you say, okay, it's all still based on the stars and it could still be literally historically true. There's actually, this is just a quick tangent. There are in the 1800s, people like Joseph Sice and Frances Rolleston, these people wrote, Frances Rolleston, she was actually before Joseph Sice. He was a minister. And they talk about the gospel and the stars and how it's all, everything in the Bible is also prefigured in the stars. And they tried to continue believing the Bible literally and notice that. You don't see a whole lot of people talking about that after the 1800s because that is a really slippery slope. If you go down that, you will not be able to maintain that position forever because what you'll quickly find is that all the other myths, well, if you pull that thread, the whole sweater will come apart eventually.
And it sounds like that's kind of what happened to you.
I mean, oh, that's absolutely what happened to me. After I saw Hamlet's Mill, they talked about the story of Samson. I've talked about this on several other places, so we won't go too far into it. But they have a whole chapter on Samson. And I happened to be in a Bible study studying the book of Judges, which is where we find Samson. At the same time, I was reading that, and I was like, that's really damaging, but maybe it's just this one kind of coincidence. Then they also point to a passage in Revelation, and I looked at that and said,
So let me interrupt again because this is one of those things. So the logic flow for you, and I think this would be for kind of a lot of people, is Samson is in the Bible. So this is scriptural. It's wisdom passed down from God. Then you make
he was a real character. He lived.
He's a real character. All this stuff, and then you go over and say, wait a minute, Samson is also portrayed in the stars, in the constellations. Moreover, I can go cross-culturally and read all these, the people who have gone and looked at these myths. So, you know, it's not just particular to our culture. There's all these other cultures that have very similar myths. So this is kind of the sweater thread pulling thing that starts to create problems for harmonizing it all back into the Bible, right? I mean, at a very, very high level, we can get into the details, but at a high level, that's kind of what's happening here, right?
That's exactly right. And I'll just throw like one detail. The authors of Hamlet's Mill mention the famous weapon that Samson chooses to slay 1,000 enemies. You know what that is? The jawbone of an ass, jawbone of a donkey. Okay, so it's said in this particular passage in Judges 14 that he reached out his hand and took the jawbone of an ass, that's the King James version, and slew 1,000 of his enemies. Now, that's a very impractical weapon. You know, you might use it in a pinch, but you probably would cast it aside after two or three and pick up one of their swords or something. But it turns out that there's also jawbone weapons in the myths of the, you know, the Pacific cultures. Maui actually uses the jawbone of his grandmother at some point. There's other jawbone weapons. And so what they point out is that Orion in the sky is right next to Taurus. And Orion's up right now, is the most dazzling constellation. You can see this very V-shaped portion of Taurus that's called the Hyades. It's very bright V.
But this is the kind of stuff that kind of sent you.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So I won't go too far into that myth, but that when I saw that, I said, oh, that's pretty damaging, but it's possible that there's a coincidence, or it's possible that God put that in the stars. Okay. So Samson is still a real character. Then you go over to Revelation and you find, hey, everything in Revelation. And because I was very familiar with the Bible at this point, by the time I was also very familiar with the stars. So it didn't take, you know, they can point out two. And then pretty soon I'm going through the Bible on my own and realizing that from first to last, and there's been other people who have said, hey, isn't it kind of coincidental that there's 12 tribes of Israel and 12 zodiac signs, 12 disciples and 12 zodiac signs, 12 Olympian gods, 12 popping up all over the place. And, you know, so there are in this kind of general study or assertion is often called astrotheology. After the first guy to use that term that I know of is Robert Taylor in the 1800s. He actually uses the term astrotheology. That term has also been used to mean other things like that have nothing to do with this concept.
Before we get too far down there, because you're really taking it to another level, a very useful level, when you talk about understanding the language of these myths. And that's what I want to get into in a minute. But I want to back you up a little bit because first I want to mention you've given some great interviews out there. People can find your interview with the Higher Side Chats, Grammarica, Where Did the Road Go, a bunch of different ones. And you have some great YouTubes out there as well. So people who are interested in the details of this can dig into it. What I wanted to do from the beginning is kind of approach it from a slightly different angle, because I have to profess my kind of total ignorance of this topic when we started. And I want to take people through some of the basics that I had to reacquaint myself with in order to even kind of begin to understand even what you consider the basics of what you're talking about. So here goes. Here are my dumb questions, or they would have been questions like a week ago, and now I guess I've kind of answered them, as everyone will probably either say, gee, you really are stupid, or yeah, I kind of get that as a refresher course. But number one, what do we see when we look up at the sky at night? I mean, this is kind of really basics, but we see these stars. Some of them are really far away. Some of them aren't so far away. Some of them are really big. Some of them are really small. But for purposes of what we're talking about here in terms of constellations, they appear as one plane painted on the night sky, right? So that's super basic, but I guess, you know, I didn't kind of totally remember that. Yeah, you know, I know that some are far away, but then some are bigger. And you know, so they have this different appearance. We all get that. We remember from the planetarium. But then the other part that I guess I had kind of totally, not totally, but I had kind of forgotten is the stars are moving across the sky. Some of the stars, we should say, some of the stars are moving across the sky from sunset to sunrise. And maybe you want to talk about that. I know it's a really basic thing, but, you know, remind people that's because that becomes, they're kind of acting out a play through the sky, as you point out. So refresh us on just that basic.
No, so that's great. So you're right. And this is what sometimes is called celestial mechanics, and don't get intimidated by it. It's, but it's not usually part of any curriculum. You can go through, you know, through 12th grade in the regular schooling system, and then 4 more years of college, and then 4 more years of graduate school, and never get any formal teaching on this unless you decide to specialize in it. So, yes, just really quickly, at the beginning, you were saying all these constellations, the stars are actually at all different distances. So even though they may, from our perspective on Earth, look like a scorpion in a very coherent outline of a scorpion, those stars are all, it's like we're inside, if you were to fill a whole swimming pool with Jell-O, and while it's still liquid, mix a bunch of sprinkles in there, you know, little like those little glitter, just mix glitter in there. And then after it gels, oh, and drop a marble in the middle, and that's the Earth. Let's just say, for our swimming pool model. Right. All those little sprinkles or glitter are at different distances, but from the marble, you might say, oh, those five stars line up and they look like a musical instrument or an outline of a person. But really, they're dispersed at different depths in the swimming pool, different distances, you know.
And they're different sizes of glitter, right? They're different.
Yeah, and they're 3D, right? It's only because you're looking at them from, okay, so your initial assertion about what the constellations are is correct. They look like they're painted on a dome, but unless you believe that we're on a flat earth with a dome spinning above us, and I have heard some people assert that. I don't really believe anyone thinks that anymore, but some people claim they believe it.
Right.
I think they're just seeing what kind of disruption they can cause. But anyway, if you accept that we're on a spinning ball, we are on a spinning earth, and we all know that that spin causes the sun to rise in the east and set in the west. But it's not really what's happening is we're spinning. It's just like if you're driving down the road and you go, oh, that billboard just zipped past. Well, which direction did it go? Well, it went towards the back of the car. Why? Because you're driving 70 miles an hour forward. The billboard looked like it's whizzed by. The same thing with the sun. We're spinning towards the east. That's why the East Coast, when they wake up in the morning, are 3 hours ahead of the West Coast in North America here. New York's on a 3 hour time difference from us here in California, because that part of the earth is spinning towards the east, and it's going to uncover the sun as the earth curves. The sun's going to pop up over that curve first on the east coast of North America, and later it'll get to the west coast of North America, and then it'll get to New Zealand, except they're across the international dateline, so it's tomorrow morning for them. But anyway, the sun goes across the sky because we're spinning that way on it. So this is the daily. There's many different layers of this. The daily motion is us spinning. The stars will do the exact same thing. They're farther away. They're suns as well, or they're, you know, bigger than the sun, some of them.
But let's just interject a little bit of complexity there, because they don't all appear to spin the same way. Some of them seem to be moving more than other ones, right?
Well, the planets, okay, so during the course of a human lifetime, we don't normally see, they're called the fixed stars because they stay the same distance from each other all the time. Now, there's some discussion about the star Sirius, and Walter Cruttenden has done some fantastic work on this. That's not my area of particular expert focus. I know Walter personally. Maybe you've had him on your show, don't know, but great researcher, has this great theory about Sirius, that perhaps we're in a very long binary relationship with Sirius in some way. And there's a lot of evidence that's starting to appear to suggest more and more that he's right. He's been talking about this for some time, and more evidence. But generally speaking, we can safely say, unless you're like a astrophysicist measuring extremely small degrees, the fixed stars remain in their places. Now, there's an annual cycle that causes, I'll get to that in a second, but the daily cycle is the constellations, they don't move. The planets look basically like stars from the Earth. Sometimes they're a little bigger, not always. They wander. So throughout the year, the planets will wander around. And that actually, the term planet means wanderer. It comes from a Greek word that means wanderer.
Huh, didn't know that.
So what happens, though, is what I think you're alluding to, Alex, is this. If you think, I use the metaphor of a living room or your dining room, if you think of the Earth, I mean, it takes time to explain all this stuff because celestial mechanics is a little bit complicated to explain, but it's not, everybody can grasp it. If the Earth is going around the edge of a round dining room table in your dining room and the sun's in the middle, it's just a simple model, and the stars are painted on all the ceilings, but the ceiling, the floor, and all four walls.
Right.
As we go around the annual orbit, the edge of that dining room table, we're going to expose different walls.
Right.
Okay. That's what happens. That's what causes the constellations to move throughout the year. So that's why we have this zodiac where we say, oh, you know, the sun appears to be rising in the Scorpion right now. And now the sun appears to be rising in the Virgin, Virgo. And now the sun appears to be rising in Leo. What's actually happening is, if you think back to the dining room table, okay, as you're going around the outer edge of the dining room table, when the Earth, remember, it spins every day on its orbit, it rotates. So it's rotating as it's going, it's making a track, it's going around the track, and it's spinning on its axis each day. When it's pointing towards the sun, you don't see, when you're on the side of the Earth that's on the inside of the table, pointing towards that ball of candle in the middle of the table, that's the sun, you're not going to see any stars. It's only when your part of the Earth turns around and you're pointing out towards the walls of that dining room that you see the constellations. So as you're going around, sometimes I use the, if you had just posters of rock stars around, you would say, oh, look, I'm passing Jimi Hendrix now. And then when you get around to the other side of the room and you look out, oh, there's Led Zeppelin or whatever. So you're not going to be able to see Jimi Hendrix if you're on the opposite side of the table from his poster. Because
right,
when the sun is in the way.
Okay, and just let me throw in two other kind of basics, and I appreciate this because again, it just kind of throws me. One is we don't normally think about it, but there's a north, south, east, west thing going on here too, right? So we can just get kind of lost in the stars, but you know, the stars appear to move different depending on their north, south, east, west orientation. That's kind of point number one. And then point number two is, depending on where we are on the Earth's surface in terms of northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, we're going to see a different show depending on where we are on the globe. You want to speak to either one of those points?
All correct. No, those are important points. So this, in my model that I just, my simple model that I just described with the dining room, the ceiling is north and the floor is south, right? Because I'm northern hemisphere centric. I'm being, you know, biased towards the northern hemisphere. The people in the south would say, hey, how come the south can't be on the ceiling? And I'd say, well, just because all the most continents are in the north. So we're going to put the ceiling is going to be north. That's up. In space, there's no up or down, right? But anyway, from the northern half of that marble that's going around the table, you're not going to be able to see the floor. You're not going to be able to see any stars on the floor because the bulge of the Earth will be in your way. To look down to the floor, you'd have to look through the bulge of the Earth, and all you see down there is the ground. But up, you can see on the ceiling, oh, there's the North Star. Oh, there's the Big Dipper. There's these circumpolar stars that are orbiting around the axis. It's all created by the Earth's axis. But the plane that we orbit the sun is, and again, this is a simple model. So people will say, wait a minute, don't forget, we're all whizzing through the galaxy at this incredible rate of speed, et cetera, et cetera. Yes, okay, but there's this point that doesn't rotate. It's like the center of an umbrella. H.A. Ray uses this metaphor. If you look down the center pole of an umbrella and spin the umbrella, the whole fabric of the umbrella is going to spin, but there'll be a central point that doesn't spin, the hub. That's where the North Star is for people in the Northern Hemisphere, and it's caused by the fact that the Earth is rotating on its axis around the North Pole. So, but out in the middle, the belt, you know, if the Earth had a belt girdling it, you know, a line around the middle, around its fat center, the equator line, and of course we're tilted, so it's not exactly with the equator, but the celestial equator would be halfway down from that North Pole or halfway up from the South Pole. And the ecliptic, because we're, that's the plane of the table. And this gets into a little bit, we don't want to get too technical, but that is important because those constellations are, the zodiac would be the band of pictures that are along the same plane as the table. That if the sun is on the table and the in the middle of the table and the Earth's going around it, it creates a plane. If I had a laser pointer from the marble going through the sun, as that marble went all the way around, it would paint a line on the walls, so to speak. That line, and that line goes through the zodiac. So that's an important, and you can see those zodiac constellations from the south and from the north. From the northern hemisphere, we look towards the south horizon to see them. From the southern hemisphere, we look towards the northern horizon to see them. And that should make sense if you kind of think of my simple model that I tried to explain.
No, it does make sense, and it plays into this story kind of in an important way, and I appreciate you going through all that very astronomy 101 stuff. But I think it is important because, as you just alluded to, the zodiac, these signs that we're all familiar with, these constellations that we're all familiar with, are going to be kind of the lead actors in this play. And part of the reason for that is because, as you just said, they just keep reappearing. There are stars of the stars that kind of keep coming through, and we all see them all the time. And then we also establish that there's these other stars up there, like in the north, that don't seem to move as much because they're at the center. We kind of now have an orientation for how, when we look out there, we see all these stars and they're kind of doing this stuff. So next step in building our kind of very basic model is, let's jump over to conventional astronomy before we kind of get into your stuff. Conventional astronomy, what they have to say about the constellations. If you go out and read Wikipedia, if you go and take any astronomy 101 website from a university like I did when we first started talking and say, okay, what are these guys saying? So if you go read Wikipedia, here are some of the notes that I've made in terms of what you're going to find. The first thing that you're going to find, but it's really the implicit assumption, so you got to be kind of careful and on guard, is that it's materialism is implied. There can be no deep meaning to the constellations because, hell, there's no deep meaning in anything. I mean, the whole universe is meaningless. So, of course, there is no meaning in any of that. That's just a given. But the other thing that I think is implicit in this that I want you to comment on, and I commend Gordon White in his book Starships, who was recently on the show, for alerting me to this, is that we have this kind of implicit assumption about progress and about what it means to be ancient and pre-industrial and how we progress. And the city predates the cathedral is the assumption. What we now know from archaeology is the opposite of that. And that is that people, as soon as they became people as we would understand them, were doing these kind of spiritual things along with kind of looking at the stars and trying to find meaning and trying to connect with the spirit world. They were doing that before they built cities. That's what all the archaeological evidence tells us. But what, if you go to Wikipedia or if you go to Astronomy 101 class, what they say is, okay, there were these people, they were hunter-gatherers, and then they built up enough resources they could build a city, and then they started writing books, and then they thought about making up stories and myths and stuff like that. So, 2 points that I want you to kind of comment on that are implicit in, but you might not catch them, our understanding of the constellations is, one is that, of course, they can't have any meaning because nothing has any meaning. And two, this is a later invention of civilized people rather than a very, very early impulse that people had. And impulse might be a bad word based on your research. But do you have any thoughts on those 2 points?
This is, gets into like a deep mystery, okay, that people in ancient times would say, do not divulge this great mystery. Even Origen, who is kind of an early Christian father, he was anathematized. He was an early Christian, but he did not believe that the Bible should be taken literally, or at least large parts of it, he said, are absolutely useless if you try and take them literally. They're full of deep meaning, but if you take them literally, he said, don't divulge the deep secrets. And I would actually be sensitive to that, like, okay, I won't divulge them. The problem is these deep secrets have been twisted and used to beat down all these other civilizations with, you know, the whole sad history of Western civilization imposing its religion on everybody else and going around converting the world. It's like, once you start doing that, you can't.
Can I hold you on there? Because maybe I kind of led us astray a little bit. But here's the basics, right? Hey, it's all about the Greeks. And then we studied the Greeks for a while and said, yeah, the Greeks were looking up the skies. They invented all these myths. Then they found the Babylonians. Oh, gosh, well, they kind of had some of the same ones. Oh, they must have been first. And then the Greeks copied from them. And then we find, you know, Chinese. Well, gee, they're over in China. There must have been some contact over there, too, because, you know, that's the only way this thing could possibly happen. What I'm trying to sensitize people to is that, you know, we all know there's these constellations, we all know there's these myths, but the way that they've been connected conventionally, you know, if someone's going to school right now, my kids, I have a kid in college and I have three kids in high school, what are they learning about the constellations and these myths and how they relate to archaeology? I mean, they are learning something, but what are they learning and why is it wrong?
Right. And I did sense the question. I was probably taking a very circuitous way to get to it. But in general, if a connection between the myths and the constellation is alleged or acknowledged, a way that it is commonly explained away is, well, primitive early humans looking at the world around them, awesome forces, thunderstorms, earthquakes, volcanoes, had to explain it. They didn't have science, so they say, well, there's a god in the volcano and he or she is mad right now. And there's the sun. And of course, all our gods will come from the sun. And so it's like these primitive gropings became more and more sophisticated as we moved along. And then we got, this is kind of the conventional,
right,
you know, narrative. We, like you were saying, you know, this myth of progress. Hey, it was early humans, then it was primitive kind of pastoral shepherding stuff. Then it was settled down in agriculture. And then we had cities. Finally, you know, we had time to look at the stars and do science and primitive science. And then it got better and better. And at the same time, the myths are getting a little bit smoother and smoother. And then finally, we get to things like, oh, you know, the New Testament. Oh, really high. In the 1800s, they would say, oh, that's the pinnacle of everything. You know, they were all kind of groping up this mountain and now we've got to the top. But, you know, and then even then they were saying, yes, but now we even know better than that because, now we can start moving beyond that. And it was
right.
And that's kind of the general timeline. And what I was trying to kind of say at the beginning is these myths are so, what I was saying with that part about this is a great mystery and the ancients said, don't divulge it. It is so deep. Evidence of incredible spiritual sophistication in these myths, because I believe I've got a lot of reasons for believing this, that they are being used as an incredible spiritual metaphor. Not just a metaphor, because actually the angle of the sun, just all by itself, you could say, well, you know, what does the constellation Scorpio have to do with my life? The sun's rising in Scorpio right now. That can't possibly influence me, or, you know, stop reading that horoscope because it can't possibly influence you. Well, actually, yes, it can. Even from a scientific perspective, we know that the angle of the sun in the autumn, in the fall, is totally different and a different feeling than the angle of the sun in the summer or in the winter. There's actually a different length of the shadows and a different feel to the earth and everything on it, and all the animals and plants respond to it in the fall. And that's a function of the angle that the light is coming in and the angle that we are to the sun and where we are on this track around the living room that I just described. And you can tell where you are on that track.
Yeah, but some of that gets kind of problematic, doesn't it, okay, David? I mean, when we start getting into the zodiac and how it's been astrology and how it's been reworked, and we have to sort through, you know, what part of it's bullshit, what part of it isn't, that the zodiac signs have changed, that there's different lengths, that there's, you know, I mean, it just gets complicated when we get too far from there are spiritual truths that are conveyed through these myths and have been for the longest time. And we can, the easiest way to just flat out see that that's true is when we start doing good science and saying, okay, cross-culturally, you know, and when we start applying, like we said, you know, how the isolationist model breaks down given archaeology. And then we throw in like Göbekli Tepe, and then we say, oh my God, I mean, these guys haven't even considered that. Or like when you read Graham Hancock and he does the same thing saying, hey, you know, forget it. Your whole time scale is just completely blown apart. And yet we go back and look at conventional archaeology and science and astronomy in this case, and they have no response to this. I mean, they're just kind of flat-footed and they just ignore it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I would say I am open to the possibility that the relationship of where Jupiter is to Earth could have, look, if I'm in a classroom, like you said, your kids are in high school, right? Here in California, I got two sons in high school. Here in California, we've got the most ugliest high school buildings imaginable. I don't know how they are where you are, but most of them are these atrocities with low ceilings. You know, the desk, so often the chair is attached to the desk, so you have to sit in a certain way. You can't even turn your chair around. Don't tell me that doesn't have an effect. Or if versus I'm in a beautiful classical building with high ceilings or arches or whatever, the shape of your room has a vibrational, I mean, the shape of the glass that you drink whiskey out of makes a difference. Like you got to drink this one out of an old fashioned and you drink that one out of a highball glass, or you drink this wine out of this kind of glass. So I'm open to the possibility of feng shui, the shape of my environment may have some kind of vibrational effect on me. And I think the Egyptians were very tuned into that. If you look at the kind of temples and buildings they were creating, and Schwaller de Lubitsch and John Anthony West get into a lot of that stuff. And I'm open to that possibility. But laying that aside, I believe it also works on a metaphor. I believe this works on these many levels, which shows the sophistication of whoever gave this ancient system to humanity. It's incredibly, incredibly spiritually deep.
Yeah, and that's ahead. What I want you to focus on, because I'm open to all that stuff too, but kind of, and this is the path that Skeptico has followed, you know, until you can really get there. And not, if you want to get there and not sound like a total new ager, you have to square off against the conventional paradigm that exists and explain why and how that conventional paradigm is just ridiculous. You know, so in Skeptico, the conventional paradigm of consciousness is you're a biological robot in a meaningless universe. When you tear that apart, everyone agrees, well, that's just absurd. I mean, it isn't even worth talking about. It's so silly. It's so stupid. I think you've done the same thing here, in that if somebody just stumbles into their Astronomy 101 class and they hear this nonsense about the constellations and about these myths, I mean, you tear that apart. You blow that up in a lot of amazing ways. Then, but the other stuff then that layers on top of that, you know, astrology and the Bible and, you know, all that stuff is really, really interesting, and I understand why that's really, really juicy. But I also want to give people a sense of just how the emperor has no clothes here in terms of Astronomy 101.
So you're absolutely right. Like, it's like doing jujitsu. If you want to pin the opponent to the mat, you have to make the right moves. And I'm happy to get into the debate and proceed through what can be proven, because I agree. Skeptico, I'm really was excited to come on this because you have a certain certain angle that you come at things, and you just expressed it, and it's fantastic. So what I can show demonstrably, and I believe, you know, convincing, you know, to the point that I changed my whole worldview, right? I was literalist Christian, and it is a major change of paradigm that impacts everything in your worldview to realize, you know what? It's like, you know that word you're using? I do not think it means what you think it means. You know that Bible you're reading? It is full of amazing truth and beauty, but it's not literal. And not only that, it is using the same system, demonstrably the same system that the Greeks are using, that the Polynesians are using, that they're using in North America. And it's even in the most ancient myths that we have. So the most ancient texts, you know, you mentioned Göbekli Tepe. There's no extensive texts, no texts at all, as far as I know, from Göbekli Tepe yet. There may find some. But we have the pyramid texts in ancient Egypt from like 2400 BC, 2400 BC. That's 4,400 years ago. We have these cuneiform tablets from Babylon, which weren't even discovered and translated until the 1800s, 2100, sometimes 2300 BC, very ancient, and they're already using this system. The Gilgamesh series is already using this system. The pyramid texts are already referring to Isis and Osiris and Set, and those myths are based on this same system, and I can demonstrate that. And so one of the objections that you've kind of alluded to that you'll find on Wikipedia, or one of the objections that are supposed debunking of this, is, oh, these constellations, they weren't even in this form, they weren't even set up until about 1000 BC at the earliest, maybe 700 BC, really.
The date keeps changing, you'll notice, depending on where you read.
That's right. But I can show you that it's being used in the Gilgamesh series, and I can even show you from Babylonian and Sumerian cylinder seals that have, you know, a figure of a human with a lion on one side and a bull on the other side or whatever. I've shown some of this on my blog that are clearly constellational to the constellations that we're using. So this is I've done extensive diagramming of some of the Gilgamesh events in the Gilgamesh myth that can be shown, at this point, Enkidu or Enkidu sleeps with this woman, and then all the animals that he used to hang out with run away from him. That's celestial, and I can show you, here's the woman, here she is spreading her clothes on the ground. The myth explains that she spreads her clothes on the ground. This is what, there's the constellation right next to it, and here's Enkidu, and then she offers him bread and wine. Oh, isn't that interesting? Bread and wine, where have I heard that before? It's, you know, this constellation is associated with this star that's associated with wheat.
So now you're getting into what you're calling the system, or we could say, you know, other times you say is the language of the myths that is reflected in the constellations. And when I say reflected, and then we get into that, you know, which is first and all that stuff, which you do an awesome job. It's a very important point. I don't want to diminish it. But how do we give people a simple idea, like you did before, an excellent thing with the jawbone. And you said, you know, look, that's clearly a constellation. I mean, it's repeatedly referenced, this constellation. And it doesn't really fit the story, except that it's in the constellation. Or you could take, I love, you know, you do a lot of Hercules. So maybe we could break down Hercules. And who is Hercules? And then what do we know about Hercules in the myths? And then what do we see in the stars?
Right.
Or so, the other way around. What do we see in the stars? And then what do we know about the myth? Either way.
Right. Great. So just really quickly, the metaphor of the language is really, I think, a good way of understanding it, because the Bible and all the other myths, I believe, are speaking the language, I'm convinced, are speaking the language of celestial metaphor. But if nobody speaks that language anymore, then the person who's trying to interpret, they're coming to us trying to tell us something, and we've got this interpreter saying, oh, he said this. You know, it's like a visitor from another country, and you don't speak their language. That interpreter can tell you, oh, he said this about the meal that you just served him. He doesn't like it. And he could have been praising the meal, and you have no idea. They're deliberately or ignorantly misinterpreting it. They're like, I think he said this, so I'm going to say this is what he said.
He said it reminds me of Hercules. And you're like, I don't know what that means. What do you mean it reminds him of Hercules?
But if you could speak the language yourself, then you could just turn to that myth and ask it, what do you want to tell me about my life? And if you learn this language, then you will be able to, I believe, interpret the myths much better than if you don't speak the language. That's just self-evident. There have been people who have talked about this before. Astrotheology is popular culture has learned about it through movies like Zeitgeist and things like that. Or you mentioned, you know, there's an astronomer who's written about some of these myths. Great work. But a lot of times the level of grammar that they're using stays basically, I don't want to sound like I'm tooting my own horn, but it's like they're at C-spot run. They haven't unfleshed all of the, if you just notice that, oh, Jesus seems to be connected to the sun, you know, because 12 disciples. If you just stick to the sun and the moon, you're not going to get the whole, that's like the most basic grammar, like in the C-spot run kind of elementary school texts. If you want to get into this really precise details of what they're trying to tell you, you have to be able to connect it to the specific constellation, such as the constellation Hercules, such as the constellation Virgo, such as all the constellations of the zodiac, because where they are on the wheel has significance in this code that they're trying to convey to us. So Hercules is almost always the most powerful figure in any I'm talking about the constellation Hercules. We all know.
So if I hear a story and I hear either, and I start hearing these elements, then I should start looking for Hercules, right? So what are the elements that—
So you have to know the constellation. So I sent you a series of images. Maybe we'll be able to stick those up in a YouTube video if you, you know, at the right points, if it's not too much work. Otherwise, but we can just refer to them. So in those images, I've got a comparison of the way that you usually see the constellations, like in Wikipedia or even on an iPhone app. You know, these iPhone apps are great for finding a constellation, but the outlines are horrendous.
Right. You look at it and you go, that's just completely—
That doesn't look
closed.
Like Hercules.
Yeah.
Right. Now, H.A. Rey, who is the author, along with his wife, in the 50s and 60s and 70s of the Curious George series, also wrote these fantastic books that has this great system of outlining the constellation. So I sent you image one, shows a comparison of like the Wikipedia way or the conventional way and the H.A. Rey way from 1952, which is so much better. H.A. Rey either knew the ancient system or he was so genius that the way he outlined it matches up with the ancient system. And I have a little caption on image one. I have standard constellation outline examples, not very helpful for finding them in the sky, not very helpful for figuring out, investigating the ancient myths. Same constellations outlined for H.A. Rey, very helpful for locating them in the sky, and very helpful for investigating the star myths. Because, for instance, as you said with Hercules, we can actually find ancient Greek vases, and it's like they're using H.A. Rey's system, or H.A. Rey's using their system. Hercules, of course, is this mythological character, but it's also a constellation, a very important constellation. It's a large, powerful-looking constellation. But if you look at the outline that you find on Wikipedia, which I have on slide two, it's horrendous. It doesn't look like a human being at all. And then I put next to it the H.A. Rey, which is clearly a figure of a powerful figure with a large square head, or sometimes it's called a keystone-shaped head. That's what H.A. Rey calls it, a keystone, holding this menacing-looking gigantic club or diamond-shaped kind of sword over his head, reaching down with one arm, has his legs in this distinctive kind of running forward look with a deep knee bend in the back knee. Then look at this ancient— this is called a black figure vase. They also had later the red figure technique was even more famous, but there's Hercules. This is in his encounter with the Amazonians, the Amazon women. And look at, he's got— I chose this one. There's hundreds, literally hundreds of ancient Greek pottery and art that you can look at where Hercules has, in some of them, the deep knee bend of the back knee is even more pronounced. I chose this one because you can see the curve of the vase makes it a little hard, but you can see he's got his hand raised over his head, just like the Hercules image. He's got one arm. The lower arm is forward. It's kind of reaching out to the back of the neck of the Amazon woman that he's subduing there in that picture. He's got kind of a square-looking head because he's wearing his famous lion headdress.
It's compelling. Particularly the bent knee thing and the sword thing. I think anyone sees that and they go, oh, okay, there's something going on here. But what does it mean, David? What does it mean that we do have this connection with the constellations, and we do have this figure now, this actor, as you sometimes say in your work, as we would think of a modern day actor who you see in different movies, but you know he brings certain qualities and traits, you know, and stuff like that. What are we supposed to conclude about that in terms of the deeper meaning of these myths?
So this same kind of— these same kind of distinctive characteristics of Hercules, once you start to learn the language, they will pop up again and again. And you'll see actually in the Odyssey, Odysseus, I believe, is connected with Hercules. In the Bible, the figure of David, King David, is connected with Hercules, the constellation I'm talking about. I've got a couple more pictures where there's a figure from a Mesopotamian cylinder seal of either Gilgamesh or Enkidu subduing a lion. The deep knee bend there is very pronounced. Even Hanuman, or from the monkey god from the Ramayana and the Vedas of ancient India, he also appears in the Mahabharata. There's a figure in the Mahabharata who's like a Hercules figure. His name is Bhima. spelled Bhima, usually pronounced Beam. He's a Hercules figure for sure. He carries a huge mace. He has an encounter with Hanuman. He's the son of the wind god, Vayu. And Hanuman says, you know, we're actually related, you and I. Well, that's because they're from the same constellation. So what does it mean? Well, this is what I had to wrestle with after, you know, we talked about my kind of pulling on the string on the sweater. As I realized that the Bible from first to last is built on these myths. Hercules is a tricky one. He's not in the zodiac, okay? I believe his significance, he's high up in the sky in the northern hemisphere. He's close to the North Pole. He's also very close to the Milky Way. And the Milky Way, so I believe that all these myths are talking about spiritual things. I believe that they are actually, it's not just primitive gropings about trying to explain the volcano or Hercules is often a thunder god. So a lot of times you'll hear kind of a conventional, oh yeah, well, those primitive people had to explain the thunder somehow. So we got a Zeus thunder god, or we have in all these different, Thor is also related to, what does Thor carry? A hammer, right? The weapon is usually, oh, by the way, it's not always a male figure. Sometimes Hercules will be a female figure. The Gorgons of ancient Greece, I show this in volume 2, which is all about the Greek myths, I believe are Hercules figures, and I show why. Hercules is actually an extremely important spiritual figure, and I believe it has to do with the Milky Way, his location on the Milky Way. He's high and lifted up. I believe it has to do with raising the spiritual consciousness and also connecting with your higher self. A second important point that I'm arguing that's really central to what I'm trying to say is I can see this system at use around the world in ways that are so distinctive and even you could use the word obscure that it's very unlikely that they just popped up separately. I believe it is a common unified system, and I'll get to your point about the...
Now, stick on that point for a second, given that we're digressing, because like you mentioned Thor. Thor is a great one. Go and compare Thor with some of the other ones and show that the isolationist thing just completely doesn't make any sense.
Well, yeah, it's worldwide. So, Thor has a chariot of billy goats or a cart that's drawn by billy goats, okay? In the Bhagavad Gita, what we're about to go to, it's very well known. It's one of the most translated and texts in the whole world, along with the Bible and the Tao Te Ching, I think are the top, translated texts into other languages. The Bhagavad Gita is beloved. It's part of a larger epic called the Mahabharata. And the Bhagavad Gita all takes place right before this battle. And it's Krishna and Arjun in this war chariot. Krishna is acting as this non-combatant charioteer for Arjun, and above their war chariot, they have a banner. And do you know who's on the banner? Hanuman. What's Hanuman doing on the banner? Well, he actually roars. So it's a special banner. It's a spiritually or magical banner because Hanuman is actually somehow animating the banner. Well, why is the banner over the war chariot? It's because the war chariot is the constellation Ophiuchus. I didn't send an actual diagram, I don't think, that shows this, but you can find it in my books and in some of my blog posts. I've got like over 900 blog posts. The war chariot is Ophiuchus. Directly above Ophiuchus is the constellation Hercules. Hercules is sometimes shown behind the chariot of Achilles. I can show you a vase with Achilles dragging the corpse of Hector behind his chariot.
So now you're going all over the world and you're saying across the world in all these different time frames, we have the same part of the sky relating to these same myths and these characters having similar qualities, in terms of
doing the same thing, like Loki's little dance to make Skadi. She has to smile. She's very angry because someone has killed her father, who's a Jotun, Thor, has killed her father, and she's mad, and she's not going to be appeased until someone gives her a new husband out of the gods of the Aesir, and then someone has to make her smile, and then Loki does this obscene dance that makes her smile. There's an obscene dance that makes a goddess smile in Japan in the Kojiki Amaterasu, an obscene dance. There's an obscene dance that makes a woman smile in the Greek myths. It's connected with the Demeter and Persephone story, when Persephone is abducted by Hades and then she doesn't come back except for a certain part of the year to make, you know, spring and summertime, and then she goes back to Hades. The mother, Demeter or Ceres, has to be made to laugh, and there's this obscene dance that goes on and makes her smile. And there's even a figure in the Bible who smiles, that readers familiar with Bible stories may be saying, oh yeah, what was that about the woman who smiled? And then she said, no, I didn't smile. And God said, yes, you did. You smiled. That was Sarah when she was told you're going to have a child. Abraham and Sarah, or Abram and Sarai, and you know, you're 80, but you're going to have a child. And she kind of giggles and laughs and says, are you kidding me? She's behind the tent door. She smiles. And God said, you smiled. I didn't smile. Yes, you did. It's the same pattern. It's the same constellations. It's Virgo in this case who smiles. Virgo is located right underneath Boötes, who's doing the obscene dance. Anyway, back to the chariot.
Before we go back to the chariot, because we've kind of just hit on one of the main points here. I mean, the main point is, along with the fact that there's this language, which you just laid out, I think in very convincing terms, people already have to be going, hey, wait a minute, that is pretty compelling that these different cultures that didn't have any contact in these ancient periods did have this same language. Something is going on here. But then the second thing that you're saying, we can get into this because it gets into, you know, is, are they ancient aliens that are coming down doing this? Is it some kind of connection with some spiritual higher power that's doing this? You know, the how is kind of the next question that's got to be bubbling up for everybody. But before we can even get to the how, I think it's important, because one of the hooks for me is it's a spiritual message that is being conveyed in these myths. A deep spiritual message that a lot of us can resonate with, because it talks about the self and connection with our higher self. Fill in some of the details there of the spiritual message that is behind these myths.
Right. So I would say that for skeptical purposes, what I can demonstrably, you know, prove may be too strong of a word, but it's pretty close to it's proven to my satisfaction. I've, you know, looked at hundreds of these, as you mentioned. I've written thousands of pages, and I've had to leave out thousands of pages simply because you can't have a 1700 page book. So I cut it down to 700, but the amount of evidence is simply overwhelming that the myths are connected to the stars with a very specific system, with a worldwide system. So that brings up the how, which we'll set aside for a second. The why, I can't prove the why, but I can tell you that I've had to wrestle very hard with the why for the past several years. And I have, I believe, some very satisfying suggestions for the why. And I would allege that's what the Bible is telling you to do too, until someone came along and said, no, this is all literal. It's like I've used the metaphor so many times, people may be getting tired of it, but it's a great metaphor, I think. It's like in The Karate Kid, Mr. Miyagi teaches Daniel-san something that he can't grasp, karate, without learning it a certain way, wax on, wax off. And all of a sudden, someone came along and said, oh no, there's no karate here. This is just about waxing the car. Don't get any higher ideas. And we're just going to take it literally and forget about its higher meaning. And I am not the first person to say the Bible is esoteric, but I am able to show with these constellations, when you can see that everything in the Bible is based on the constellations, you cannot say, well, you can still allege that it's all literal, but it becomes very, very hard to do so, especially when you realize, wait a minute, over here in Greece, we've got a foot washing scene in the Odyssey, a foot washing scene where Odysseus's nurse, Eurycleia, washes his feet. Remember, there's a foot washing scene in the Bible. Now, which one of those two is literal? Oh, just the one in the Bible? is there a real Odysseus? No. He's a mythical character. How do you know he's a mythical character? Well, he fought a cyclops, so of course he's mythical. Okay, but Jesus is a literal character with a foot washing scene that exactly parallels. There's so much in the Odyssey that parallels the Bible. Anyway.
Because hold on now, because, you know, we're going to move now into the skeptical portion of the show, if we haven't been there already. Let's say you're right, and I believe you are right. There is this language. Could it be that then this language was well understood and then used as a vehicle so that at some point the language or the story makers were no longer accessing the same original information, if we leave off the ancient alien, God manifesting through spirit, gnosis, leave that over to the side and say, whatever that was has been given, but now, okay, I got it. I understand it. So I can go out and write a story, and I will use those same characters. I will use them in a similar way to what's been done in the past because people are going to resonate with that. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yes, I think so.
So here's what I'm saying. It kind of goes to like the thing I sent you on Atwell with the prefiguring. You know, so Atwell, Joseph Atwell, who's been on the show, wrote this book, Caesar's Messiah, kind of this mythicist Jesus thing, which we've talked about a lot on this show. One of the points he makes, which I think is really a strong point, he says, look at the life of Moses and Jesus. Whoever wrote these stories was creating these parallels in Jesus's life. So that you kind of got this idea, either directly or subconsciously, that this person was of the same stature as Jesus. You know, he had to travel. The king was mad and killed all these babies. He crossed this body of water. You know, hey, these same things keep happening. 40 days was out, you know, 40 days in the desert, 40 years in the desert, 40 days. Hey, 40 again. So his point is that someone wrote the Bible and those writers specifically used some of these things because they knew that their audience would identify with the story, would gravitate towards the story if they used it as a literary vehicle. And so I'm saying, could you be right about everything you're saying, but then at some point, could it then become a literary vehicle that we're seeing rather than, again, a reconnection to the spiritual source, however that source comes into being?
Yeah, great. I'm definitely familiar with Joseph Atwell's work and address it in The Undying Stars, and I respect what he has discovered. I believe he has discovered something real and something important, but I don't agree with all the conclusions that he makes. I believe he's discovered a psyop, okay, that is correct. Josephus was involved. So the conclusions that he draws is that, oh, the New Testament is just the Gospels is just a vanity piece, you know.
Right. No, he goes too far.
Political. No, I don't think it is. I think the so-called New Testament is as ancient as the so-called Old Testament. Okay, could it be clothed in the language of Roman times? Absolutely. It was clothed in the language of Roman times. I mean, when we read our New Testament, those characters are running around in Roman times. We're being told this is happening in the time of the governor Quirinius and Tiberius is the Caesar, and this is happening at the Sea of Galilee, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the ancient myths by someone who's very familiar with them, very immersed in this tradition, which Josephus, by his own admission, was,
right,
could be dressed up in Roman times.
Similarly with the Greeks, right? So the Greeks are writing these stories and they're writing these myths, and a lot of different things are happening. One, they are maybe receiving some kind of divine inspiration, gnosis, but I think, and I'm going to push on this point one point further because I haven't heard you talk about it, but if, as you say, I think it builds on your point. If, as you say, this is a language that was understood and that understanding has been lost, maybe when these people were writing these stories, they were just, it was just a natural part. You know, you're a literary guy. You understand, you know, that the vehicle that they use would just be second nature to them to talk about a Herculean figure in such a way and a chariot in such a way as they're constructing their own story.
Right. So I believe it's like Mr. Miyagi going, okay, this kid's getting beaten up. I am a karate master. How am I going to reach this kid? My dad didn't actually teach me by waxing the cars back on Okinawa. He taught me with a different set of metaphors. But I got to reach this guy. Here I am in Los Angeles, and this poor kid from New Jersey's getting beaten up by Johnny and his buddies. Okay, wax the car. Paint the fence. An important point. Mr. Miyagi had to know the higher system before he could reach down to the lower realm, so to speak, and say, wax the car, that'll work. Okay, paint the fence, that'll work. So people who say this is primitive gropings that evolved out of trying to explain the thunder god or trying to explain the volcano is wrong. It's you got to know the higher system before you can come up with these incredible metaphors to teach it. You got to know karate before you can be Mr. Miyagi and say, how am I going to teach this kid? Okay, wax a car. You can't use the metaphor of, you know, we've got electrical outlets and you say, oh, this is a male outlet and that's a female outlet. It's not like the outlets actually have sex, right? It's a metaphor. But you can't even come up with that explanation if you're 8 years old and you haven't a clue what sex is really all about. No 8-year-old comes up with that metaphor.
Right.
Only someone who knows what sex is can say, oh, yeah, well, use the female. Wait, put the female end of the socket over there. See what I'm saying?
Great point. Yeah, absolutely. It's a great point.
So it is not primitive gropings that somehow, oh, look at this. These primitive myths somehow later on, thousands of years later, evolved to point to incredible spiritual truths. It's like saying, yeah, people were waxing the cars for centuries and then boom, they knew karate as a master. That's just ridiculous.
Oh, okay, so good. So let me stop you there. I got to fire these things at you. Skeptical kind of question number two that popped up for me. And you've alluded to this a couple times, and I just can't quite get where you're coming from. Are the stars, the constellations, a visual teaching aid, or is there some kind of interactive relationship between actually some kind of energy in the stars and the story? So I'm a very ancient, I'm either, you know, an ET or I'm a spirit being or whatever the hell, we're going to leave that. We're going to touch that one next, but I'm this, and I'm going to try and convey this message to you. And as you just alluded to, I need metaphor. And you don't have much, so I can say, hey, if you forget what I'm saying, just look up there and see that thing there? Well, that looks like that. Well, that's what I'm kind of talking about. Here's the story. It'll play out all the time, and you don't have a written language, so this is the best I can give you. How about that? Is that what's going on, or is there something more?
My experience and study and thinking and meditating about this suggests that the answer is yes to both questions. But primarily, I'm most comfortable saying, it is a spiritual teaching aid. The stars are visible, but they are talking about the invisible realm. But the invisible realm is real. In other words, is there a goddess Athena? Yes, there may be. To understand her particular characteristics, the myths appear to match her up with a specific constellation. That constellation has specific characteristics that point to this particular aspect of the invisible realm. But the constellations are not them. The constellations are, hey, you can't see them. That's the invisible realm. Maybe you can see them in some vision when you're in non-ordinary reality. Notice I didn't say it's not reality. It's just not ordinary reality where you're having a vision. But the stars are a representation to point you to the invisible realm because I cannot show you the invisible realm. I can't show you karate. I can show you this car. Now wax it. And then you'll know karate. You'll know it.
And when you want to pass this story along to your grandchildren, it's going to be helpful for you to be able to say, hey, look up there in the sky. You see that? Now let me tell you the story. And then they can. So it's a vehicle that works in terms of passing along the oral tradition.
It's an incredible vehicle. It works on so many levels. And in fact, when you do look out into the night sky, you are gazing into the infinite realm. When I look into the night sky, I'm looking into infinity, period. No astrophysicist that I know of will probably dispute, and maybe some will, I don't know. But it's infinite. And it works on all these levels, all these spiritual deep levels. So it's a perfect metaphor. Whoever came up with it, it's like beyond Mr. Miyagi. Where did it come from? We could talk about, but it is a, I believe, a visible teaching aid for the invisible realm that is real. Now people can say, hey, I don't buy the invisible realm. Okay, you don't have to, but I believe that's what these ancient myths are talking about.
I disagree. I think you have to. I think if you don't, then you get into the kind of the modern kind of, you know, apologetics, twisting things back to make things. You got to make that leap to kind of make this stuff work. And
well, I'm saying that's what they were trying to say. Now,
I'm agreeing with you.
But I think there's plenty of evidence that is true. I mean, there's evidence that you have a higher self. There's evidence that people are able to sometimes, I mean, the military has used psychics to find downed helicopters on, you know, in other continents. How are they doing this?
No question. I mean, if you're stuck in the biological robot meaningless, then that's another psyop that we can talk about for another time. But so here, we've built up to maybe this is kind of one of the big questions also that I'm sure is on people's minds. The who question, and we keep alluding to it. What do you think about the ancient aliens idea as it applies to this? And then what do you think about the ascended masters thinking about the, as it relates to this, the Akashic records as it relates to this? Any thoughts on any of those things?
Yeah, so, certainly I definitely have thoughts on it, as I'm sure everyone else does. I would say that, once again, all I can definitively show is that these things appear to be worldwide, a very advanced spiritual system. So it came from something. And all cultures revere, you know, whoever gave these to them, whether it was the gods or the spirits or the shaman of old who were able to go to the spirit realm and bring back the knowledge. I am not dogmatic as to where it came from. I think it is possible to explain it without ancient aliens. And I think that a lot of what ancient alien advocates lean on is the myths and taking them literally. And I'm saying, wait a minute, I can show you that's not literal right here. The Anunnaki, you want me to show you what I think that is? It's not literal. So I believe that Göbekli Tepe shows very ancient, advanced activity going on, so much more ancient that could possibly explain why we're already seeing this system apparently in full flower at the time of the ancient, earliest Egyptian text, earliest Mesopotamian text. This system's already in place. So it's got to be very ancient. And it's possible that everyone who goes to the spirit realm comes back with some version of this. You know, maybe the use of sacred plants, you know, you go to the alternate, the other realm, and you get taught, hey, this is the way to explain this stuff. And that explains why it's all around the world. Or maybe there was a very ancient, advanced human culture or cultures thousands and thousands of years before the Egyptians, like Göbekli Tepe time and earlier. And remember, Plato talks about Atlantis, and his dating, as Robert Schock has shown, lines right up with Göbekli Tepe. And maybe that ancient civilization, not Egyptian, long, long before the Egyptians, was wiped out by a disaster, a catastrophe, solar flares, cosmic war. Maybe they blew each other up. Maybe, you know, maybe whoever blew the atmosphere off Mars took care of that civilization too. Who knows? But maybe we have remnants of that scattered. The survivors carried it to all points of the world. I don't know. So I'm not going to be dogmatic about it. Although I would say you don't need ancient aliens to explain this. I think it's just as likely that ancient people able to cross to the other side came up with this system. You know, men and women of great spiritual depth in the very ancient past came up with this system or received this system from the other side somehow.
Right. And we don't even know to what extent that's an either or proposition, right?
Sure. I don't think we can be dogmatic about it. I certainly don't see any way to prove at this point.
Are some of the ETs somehow in these extended consciousness realms that are in the same that we're crossing over into, or what is the hierarchy there? Yeah, we can't even pretend to have an intelligent idea about that. One last question here, David, before I let you go. Implicit in what you're saying is this kind of tutelage between a higher being. Again, we'll leave aside whether ET or spiritual, whatever, and a not very advanced being. I mean, we can fill in that story with all kinds of ideas, but have you thought about that? I mean, this is the story of, you know, the Planet of the Apes that you like to use, only it's a different story. It's somebody who knows a lot trying to teach something to somebody who doesn't know crap. That's implied in what you're saying. And the implications for that, I think, go beyond. You have to go through all the steps that you went through to get to that point. But then at the end of the day, you're going, well, wait a minute. That really does fit more to an ancient aliens kind of scenario. Not only is it an advanced knowledge, but it's an advanced knowledge that realizes that they have to dumb it down in a very particular way in order to communicate it to their audience. What is that saying about the relationship between that early audience? Because we do see layers that are added onto it afterwards, but in some of these cultures, it's more or less primitive, if you will. And then in some other cultures, it's very highly elaborated and developed. I mean, the story in the Bhagavad Gita is extremely elaborate, and from a literary standpoint is pure genius. But, and not to demean other cultures, but in other cultures that are even pre-language, it's much simpler. Not pre-language, but without a written language, simpler story. So right. what do you make of that? I mean, what does that say about?
Yeah, I would say that they're probably all extremely spiritually sophisticated, right? Why do people have to feel like they have to go? It's like, you know, we've got a rush of people going to the Amazon to get in touch with, because there's something missing in our extremely technically illiterate. Right. We don't want to demean those other cultures, because actually they're incredibly spiritually sophisticated and have plenty to teach. You know, it's like you could learn a thing or two from those primitive.
No question. But the story that you're painting is a bunch of people around the campfire, and there's somebody who's really wise, and they're saying, look, you guys don't have any clue on any of this, and you're going to forget about it when I'm gone, but look up in the stars, and here's the story that you should tell your grandkids now. Right. I got to go. Goodbye.
And it's an extremely interesting question, because what your first question, the first part of that question before I kind of dealt with the sidetrack part of it by saying, hey, look, they're all spiritually sophisticated, and we both acknowledge that. But the question is, how did this get started? Or obviously in the Daniel-san needed the Mr. Miyagi. And I do believe that if you look in most cultures, and probably all cultures, it's kind of passed down in a master to disciple type of thing, like Obi-Wan Kenobi and Luke, or Yoda and Obi-Wan Kenobi or whatever. It is passed down that way. You know, you're saying, how did one person, I can't take credit for all this stuff. I have had times where it's like, how did I went to bed not knowing it. I was thinking about it. I woke up in the morning, and while I was taking a shower, like, I realized I had the answer. Where'd that come from?
Yeah, but that would answer things on a different level, because the gnosis kind of thing and how things pop up. But
you're asking, how did it get started?
and specifically as it relates to a particular orientation to these stars, that to me sounds more human, if you will. That sounds more like, you know, an Atlantis kind of, we have to restart civilization. Let's hop in our, more human or more ET-like or more something like that. Okay, let's stop in this spaceship. We'll fly over here, this group of people. Let's tell them the story. Now let's get back in the spaceship, fly over here, tell them the story. And we'll always point up at the stars and stuff like that. Because if I'm just, you know, God, and I'm just kind of telling you to kind of love everybody, you know, well, that we know it pops up in people's dreams in a bunch of different ways, and they have these near-death experiences, but people aren't having near-death experiences and coming back and saying, oh, they told me about, you know, that particular star, and those three stars connect to create a foot and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Well, it's a very interesting question that you ask. And I just want to say, I think, you know, I enjoy your show and this conversation in particular, because you're coming at me with questions that are your expertise, or you're good at asking different questions than I get asked. You know, every human being is different, of course. So I appreciate this question. I would say that, look, whether we posit an ancient human civilization that evolved, you know, maybe by the time it got to Göbekli Tepe, maybe it had already evolved for 10,000 years or 10 million years. I don't know.
Right.
Or if it came from ancient aliens, where'd they get it? Presumably they evolved somewhere, right? So it's like we've got two choices. Either this came from the spirit world right off the bat, or some culture evolved to some incredibly advanced level and figured it out, right? Because if the aliens brought it, where'd they get it? Well, you know, the aliens might say, well, we've been on planet Zeta Reticuli for 250 million years. And, you know, after 200 million years, we finally evolved to a level where we figured it out. Okay, so it evolved. Or did you get it from the spirit world?
Right.
Now, maybe they're not mutually exclusive. Maybe you got to evolve to a certain degree where then you can say, hey, this plant, that'll get me in contact with the spirit world, or this mushroom.
No, I'm with you on all that. I just, and I don't know if this is a leap or if something you've thought about a lot, but what you specifically have kind of revealed here, I think, that has to be dealt with is the vehicle for telling the spiritual story is the stars. And so the question I'd have is, why that vehicle? We know there's other vehicles, right? So we know the plant is a vehicle, the psychedelic experience, you know, that's a vehicle. The shamanic journey, you know, that's a vehicle, you know, maybe it's the same. But you're saying, here's another vehicle. Why was that vehicle chosen that, okay, look up at the stars and I'm going to tell you a story about that? Why that?
That's a great question. And I certainly don't mean to close the door on the alien possibility. I just don't think it's necessary. I don't think it's unnecessary, but I'm open to it. But I think the stars are a perfect vehicle, and it could be because there's aliens involved. I'm not denying that as a possibility, but I think it's like Herman Melville struggling to figure out, how am I going to wrestle with these deepest, biggest questions? I mean, his other works are fantastic, but of course he's known for Moby Dick. And he said, I need a bigger canvas. I need a bigger canvas. What's the biggest canvas I can find? I know, the ocean. And then Moby Dick is one metaphor after another. He used the biggest, most majestic, most awe-inspiring, most terrifying, most also, you know, mundane and tedious life at sea. Was a canvas big enough for him to put in all these things that he's wrestling with in Moby Dick? Well, I got a canvas even bigger than that. It's over your head. It's the ocean of the stars. And it is the biggest canvas, the most majestic, awesome mechanisms. You know, we didn't even talk about precession. It's just awe-inspiring. It puts us in our place, and it conveys to us the awe and the power of the invisible realm. And it's infinite. It's the infinite realm. It's the realm of the gods. So it is a perfect canvas. But your question has at the back of it a very interesting additional corridor that goes down, you know, maybe forever, and we never get the answer. But who, why, how? I don't know. Somebody very advanced, either humans in touch with the spirit world or aliens in touch with the spirit world, advanced aliens, advanced humans. I don't know, but I can tell you the evidence is there that this system exists. It's worldwide. It's amazing. It's profound. And it's ancient.
So, David, where do you take this? More books? More? There's a movie here someplace that somebody has to make some point. Where do you go with this material?
Oh, yeah. I definitely want to try and share it with people who are interested in it. I think it has a lot of benefits for people, you know. Just the fact that I don't think hell is a literal place, you know, that could be liberating to a whole lot of people. So I do have a lot of books rattling around, vying for the top spot to, you know, that wants to pop, which one wants to pop to the surface first. I do think that, you know, we started this off with kind of the celestial mechanics. This would be good to teach as a course or visually. So there may be ways to do that, and certainly movies. It does cry out for movies. You can see I've tried to make my own. It's hard to capture the stars on a screen properly, but Yeah, I do think that there are 40 more volumes that could easily be written. And even the ones that I've written, I could go back and go deeper on so many of the myths of ancient India or myths of the Pacific that I don't feel like I did. I of course, couldn't do justice to them because I was trying to show so many different myths from around the world. So to go back and do more justice.
You really invite people to be part of the myth-making process. So in the true sense of discovering or revealing a hidden language, you're saying, okay, now you know the language. How do you apply it, both in understanding these other myths, but then in understanding your own myth?
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that. And I absolutely do think that, you know, don't look to me, look to the myths and to your own experience and meditate on them deeply yourself. And so, yeah, the books are written almost as a participatory. You're supposed to be participating in the decoding of them. It's like a puzzle book where the first half tells you the myth and then says, okay, now think about this. here's some clues that I might want to point out to you. Now turn to page 260 and you'll see what I think about it. And hopefully that presentation method works or is helpful to people. And it was suggested to me actually by a reader. So tremendous thank you to all the different people who have written to me and to that particular reader, Jody, who suggested that I find some way to try and help people decode or learn to decode for themselves instead of me just decoding it and saying, yep, here's the message. Here's what I've decoded for you.
Because the decoding is what really is the gnosis process. So what would you say would be a good starting point for people who are kind of new to this and are intrigued? Where should they start?
Yes. buy 5 copies of all books. No, I'm just kidding. You can go to my blog for free and read 900 entries there. I've got some, my website, Star Myth World, has I think 39 at present myths up there. There's many more in the blog posts, which is fully searchable. The blog is on the website too, Star Myth World. You can get there. There's resources at the bottom of each page. There's a link that says resources where you can go to some of the authors that I've referenced here from previous centuries. I've put some of those books that are available online that you can read online right there.
Which book of yours should they start with? Just volume one?
It's really personal preference. So volume 1, 2, and 3, volume 1 tries to be more introductory and go broadly across many continents. Volume 2 goes deeply into the Greek myths. Volume 3 goes deeply into the Bible. So almost exclusively the Bible in volume 3, almost exclusively Greek in volume 2. And kind of a wide overview in volume 1. Actually, I think going deep is actually better. But there are reasons to start with volume 1, but I say you don't have to. If you want to start with volume 3, the Bible, because that's what turns you on, and then go to volume 2 and then volume 1, you could do them backwards, 3-2-1. Or if you want to do Greek myths, go to 2. The Undying Stars is actually still one of my most popular books. That's the one before this series, and that kind of also gives a broad overview. It's before. So I wasn't, there's some star myth stuff in there, certainly a lot of it, but it even gets into quantum physics, which we didn't get into, but you know, quantum physics has basically acknowledged the existence of a potential realm, a realm of potentiality, which I believe the realm of the gods could be explained as a realm of pure potential, right? The implicate order that David Bohm talks about. Anyway, the Undying Stars kind of gives the bigger picture, what's going on, what do I think it means. But my understanding of the myth system itself is now far beyond where it was even when I wrote The Undying Stars. So, you know, I would say people start wherever you want. You might want to start with volume 3, the Bible. If you're really, really familiar with the Bible or really curious about the Bible or really racked with doubts about the Bible. You know, every time someone comes to your door and says, if you don't listen to this, you'll go to hell. You close the door and afterwards you go, but what if I'm wrong? Well, then maybe start with volume 3, because I think it's pretty clear that the literalist understanding is not correct. And if you read volume 3, I think you'll have a lot more security that it's not literal.
Well, you know, like I said at the beginning of the show, it's an amazing body of work, but it's even more amazing and so encouraging and uplifting that one person, again, without any academic affiliation, not a kind of room full of graduate students going into helping you, has, you know, and I understand you're a humble guy and you're standing on the shoulders of other people, but you've made a huge contribution here and you're just to be commended for it, David. It's just great work. And I really hope that people check it out. It's been great having you on the show. Thanks a lot.
Thanks very much, Alex. I really enjoyed talking with you.
Thanks again to David Matheson for joining me today on Skeptico. I guess there's really only one natural, logical question to draw from this interview, and that is, what do you make of David's theory? Do the constellations and their associated myths point to a very, very old system of knowledge, of spiritual knowledge, that has somehow been passed down to us through the night sky? So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. It's quite controversial, quite thinking outside of the box. But as you know, that's what I love to bring you on Skeptico. So the place to get in touch, of course, as always, is through the Skeptico website, skeptiko.com. You can download all of our previous shows for free. You can subscribe on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to connect. Either send me an email, connect with me through my Facebook page, or through the Skeptico Forum, which is my favorite place to connect with listeners. Well, as I'm recording this, it's the end of 2016. It's been another terrific year for me in terms of Skeptico, and I've enjoyed so many of the shows that I've brought to you this year, and I look forward to doing the same in 2017. So, Happy New Year, take care, and bye for now.